Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew, and I'm very excited about tonight's show. Tonight, my guest is Cliff High, and if you aren't familiar, he's a computer scientist, linguistic. He's a founder of the predictive linguistics field, which is a powerful process that analyzes vast amounts of data that has actually predicted future events. But Cliff also has a vast knowledge of things esoteric, or as he calls it, all things woo-woo. How you doing tonight, Cliff?
Doing fine. How about yourself?
I'm very good, and I want to thank you again for joining us, and I thought we'd start out with, well, a little bit about your background as it pertains to the esoteric and, you know, kind of what opened your eyes to the world behind our world and the things that they don't teach us in our history books.
I got the crap beat out of me when I was a kid. I kid you not. I was a military brat. My father had been stationed in Germany as part of the occupation forces, and the military allowed him to bring over family. And I had barely arrived in southern Germany. Maybe 2 days I'd been there. Was out walking in the woods, met another military brat, and for whatever reason at the time we were both kids, we got into a fight, and I was just thoroughly pummeled. I mean, like, the guy had reach. There was nothing I could do, right?
Yeah.
And so my father decided, well, this wasn't good. If you're going to get into fights, you should learn how to do it. So he took me to this guy who taught judo on base to soldiers, but also ran a judo dojo after hours. And he said, well, you're too skinny for this, really, so you got to put on some weight. So go and do yoga. Eat a lot, do a lot of yoga. And well, I had to start looking into yoga because I didn't know what the hell it was. I was like 10 years old. Bear in mind, this is back in the 60s before yoga had hit the airwaves, so to speak.
Right.
And so I looked into that, and I did Kano Jiu-Jitsu, it was actually called. This was in the early days before it was seriously named judo everywhere. And before it went into like the Olympics, that was sort of the split then in the early 60s. In any event, though, because I started looking into that, one thing led to another, and I started practicing yoga at age 11 along with doing martial arts. And it's a, you know, sort of a mind-opening situation.
Very good. Very interesting. Now, based on that, would you say that we live in a universe where there are other dimensions?
No.
No. Okay.
No. Now, see, there's the thing. I wouldn't say that because we would have to first define what we meant by dimensions. If, for instance, one was to say, to ask it another way, are there areas in life that we cannot perceive? Oh, certainly. No question. Now, do we define X-ray band as a dimension? Do we define ultraviolet as a dimension? Do we define microwaves in all of their plethora as a dimension? If so, then okay, I would have to agree that there are other dimensions. But then if you're talking about dimensions in the sense that we could somehow open up a portal and slip corporally through that portal, and still be corporally available to ourselves on the other side of that portal in some other dimension? No.
So what are your thoughts on, people saying that they can astral travel to different dimensions and speak with different entities?
Okay, that's a different understanding of what's, or that's a representation that is not exact in the language as to what they're actually experiencing. Astral travel, sure, no problem with that. Done it myself, well aware of how that works. Other dimensions in the sense of consciousness, yes, those would exist, okay? But then it gets really muddy. The reason being that humans are so inexact with their own minds that mostly, which would be to say 999% of the time out of 1,000, I mean, just seriously, minute fraction of the time we have our minds under control. The rest of the time we could not tell the difference between our imagination and dimension. So most people, if they were to hear me say that, well, there are other dimensions in astral travel, then they would have experiences that they would assume meant they were going into another dimension. Now, if you're talking about a consciousness perception that's not imagination, and we wanted to define that as another imagination, then I would, or as another dimension, then I would say there is indeed such a thing. However, in order to arrive there, one must pass through what we could label the dissolution barrier. And on the other side of that dissolution barrier is a place that I would refer to as hyperspace. I wouldn't call it a dimension per se, but truly in a sense of what we're talking about now, about a place that our consciousness could go to and wouldn't have to, we wouldn't be corporeal, but your consciousness could certainly go there. This hyperspace could be considered in all respects a dimension in the way that we think of it from TV.
So it would be possible to theoretically meet the consciousness of another being in that space.
It's possible, and I've done that with the assistance of psychedelic drugs. I've done it with the assistance of years of psychedelic drugs, and then a hiatus, and then years of meditation. So I've done it under two sets of circumstances. I know that people such as my brother, who was a full-fledged schizophrenic, he's done it because of the adrenochrome that floods your system and throws your mind out of whack when you're a schizophrenic, right? And so, and I know of a couple of other mental conditions that also cause this to occur. And so in that sense, I would say that that's part of our reality. And anybody that's ever experienced that, especially through things like DMT or psilocybin, would agree with me when I say it is more real than real. It's much more real to you, much more real in feeling than the material world that you and I are occupying and talking through right at the moment. It's really spooky when you go through it. Now, in my experience, to get to hyperspace requires that the person go through a dissolution phase. By that, I mean an actual, what psychiatrists might describe as an ego death or an ego dissolution. But it feels like when you're going through it, that your body is dissolving into atoms. Okay, and then you pop out on the other side in hyperspace.
Very interesting. Now, let's talk a little bit about the entities you said that you came into contact with. Could you maybe describe that experience a little bit, or those experiences?
Bear in mind, it took place over a number of years. Okay, okay. So there were a number of experiences. There were discrete entities that were reoccurrent and persistent over the years. And then there are entities that may have been reoccurrent every time I went there, but you couldn't tell because they represented themselves just as spheres. Okay, in hyperspace, you don't have a body. Your consciousness is there. The native, most efficient shape for consciousness and universe is a sphere. And, in all different ways. In terms of energy specifically, though, it's easiest to contain your consciousness in a sphere and not have to worry about the little fiddly bits that stick out, right? This is true in hyperspace. So it costs you an energy penalty in hyperspace to have a body other than a sphere. So hyperspace, in my experience of it, was littered with spheroids that were the housing of various different consciousness. And it was not possible for me to really see much in the way of a difference from one sphere to another, excepting there were some whose behavior was so striking as to let you know that they were not, so you could pick them out of the crowd, so to speak. So bear in mind that this is a psychedelic experience, and it is filled, it's a place that is filled with no boundaries. So there's no sense of a boundary between your body and the hyperspace at all. And yet it is filled with light, sound, action, dynamic activity, seemingly random dynamic activity, and individual consciousnesses within there that are able to be stable within that environment. And some of them are friendly, so to speak, and they'll interact with you. Some of them are quite nice guys and very friendly, but very rarely. And then a lot of them are just basically indifferent to you, or having such a terrible time on their own, they don't want to be hassled. So there's a lot that meet that latter criteria. So I think a lot of beings, or a lot of consciousness houses like we are, somehow find themselves in other worlds, other planets, and they get into a psychedelic experience, and they don't know what they're handling and don't know how to handle it. And so they pop in, and they're just not able to deal with anything other than themselves in that gigantic space of vast quantities of chaos.
Now, did you ever encounter anything that resembled more of a being you could describe?
Sure. I've had contacts with a guy that was basically a hominid, had a much flatter face and a flat kind of a forehead and a flat top to his forehead. And this being had two eyes, a nose, smallish kind of ears, regular mouth, regular teeth, had a very fine and transparent body hair, just more or less like a human male. But this being had the unique characteristic of showing its emotions in like a little aura layer that ran across the top of its skin over its entire body.
Huh.
This being was psychic. It was a male I was talking to. I had no way of establishing a name with him. And he and I met several times over the course of perhaps 2.5 years, and we traded information and ideas. He was very interesting because of the nature of his expression in life, where his emotions came out in this haze over his skin, as did all the members of his species. And so some of the things you learn is that he's telepathic, and then he's also telepathic at an emotional level, because he's literally broadcasting his emotions out throughout his skin continuously, millisecond by millisecond. And so to someone else of his species, they can read this because they felt those same emotions and complexes and what he called chords, like a musical chord of emotions before. And so there's no need for words in many cases if you're attempting to express an emotion. So they have poetry without words. So really interesting concept when you drill down on that, right? There's no words in their poetry, but insofar as we would consider it, it's exquisitely evocative poetry. And they have big contests, and it's a big giant national sort of or global sort of a thing for their species. He's very intelligent. He's I haven't seen him in, I don't know, 40 plus years. He's not a local boy. We were able to establish that from our relationship, he's on the other side of the Milky Way galaxy from us, and that the hyperspace that we entered into just simply allowed the communication between us, but in no way could establish a physical connection. It wasn't like we were, transporting ourselves there. But he was the one who taught me to project my body out in hyperspace, and he was very forthcoming with information, but he wanted quid pro quo. And his problem, which I was able to help him out with, was that the environmental conditions on his world were changing, and they had issues relative to how they built things and these environmental changes. And insofar as I remember how it was described to me, they were having like irradiation issues from local suns, okay, that caused various different kinds of atmospheric effects. And it had never in their entire culture, and it's probably because they projected their feelings out over their skin, and they had fashion and they had clothing, but their skin was hardened to the environment that they lived in, so they didn't need it to stay warm or anything, right? They didn't need clothing for that purpose. And so for them, fashion was something else entirely, more like what we might think of as jewelry. It was an accessory, you know, but in any event, they never dawned on them to develop surface coatings. And so like I was talking to him, and he and I had done this exchange, and so I'd thought about his problem over the course of several weeks. Next time I went on one of these journeys, I met him again and said, aha, here's your solution. That exists this possibility of taking various different kinds of chemicals, and I had gone to the local state library in Olympia and looked up various different ways of making paint. And so had in my head how various things like silica and oils being composed of petrochemicals that, or, you know, could be created from animals or plants, et cetera, because I didn't know what kind of conditions they had on their home world, right? In his home planet. And so, but it basically told him the idea is to provide a sacrifice surface coating, and then to make that sacrifice surface coating last a little while, you make it better and better and better, and you put enough effort into it that it's not a sacrifice every year to the irradiation, the solar irradiation, but lasts 10 or 20 years, that sort of thing. And so it was like, oh, he was just fantastically thrilled with this idea.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Now, I understand you had a much different experience with a different type of being, an insectoid being.
Two of them, those critters, insofar as I was able to tell. And see, there you've got to be careful, right? Because there's no way I could ascertain whether meeting a being over the course of many different excursions over many different years, if it was the same guy presenting himself in two different...
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Forms or not. So I had an encounter with an old insect who was really pissed at me for being there. And then later on, I had an encounter with a younger insect. Might have been the same one. It might have gone through some kind of metamorphoses, or time may be goofy in hyperspace, so I may have met it when it was very young and then met it when it's very old, met that part of him first. I have no way of knowing. I've always assumed it was two separate beings and that they were separated by many generations of bugdom. And they were very interesting things, quite the strange mind. So the guy with the emotions on his skin, whatever we want to call him, he's basically a human and has emotions and has a vagus nervous system. And, would get a stomach ache, could have those kind of ills, these sorts of things. And so he's basically a human. The bugs had no emotional life. So, or another way, actually, I don't really want to put it that way. A better way to think of it is that they have an emotional life that consists of basically one note, just a single note continuously, whereas ours is multifaceted, multi-chorded, multi-dimensional, and multi-rhythmic. They just have one. And so, and the reason I say that they actually have that one, is because there's got to be something that changes them from satisfied to dissatisfied. And so something in there causes them, prompts them to act as the environment around them changes, and something triggers them into a sense of being dissatisfied, and then they react to that. But other than that, they really don't have an emotion, and you get that from the mind. Now, these are very powerful mental beings, okay? The insects, so the guy with the emotions on his over him, I could always see a faint haze as he was projecting his emotions, just like his real body back on his home world. But the detail that he was projecting of his face and his body would fade in and out as we were both distracted by what was going on. And the energy in his mind to maintain that was shifted to various different focuses. Not the case with the bugs. They were always like, you know, basically they're solid, you know, no fuzz to them at all. And so the level of the mind it took to project at that level, you could feel the power when you encountered them in hyperspace. And it's not like there's rooms or divisions there, but it is as though you could, if you wanted to, put your focus over this way and just simply ignore anything over here and not have to deal with energy going in your mind, section off this area into like focus rooms, so to speak, and not have to deal with the bugs if you wanted. What really irritated this first older bug, and this is when I was still a sphere, I didn't really know how to make a body at that point, was that he pissed me off. And I got irritated, and so I said, no, I'm not going to leave. Because he, you know, as soon as I popped into his focus room area, he basically tried to use his mind and push me out. And it like really pissed me off. And I was very into Aikido at the time. So mentally what I did was, even though I was a sphere, was I just sort of grabbed his energy and rolled with it, right? And just let it flow beside me, and I was still there. And so I, when he got done with that, I told him, no, I'm not going to leave. You've really irritated me, and I'm going to stick right here until I've gotten some irritation back out of you. And then he was really pissed at me after that, but he went about his business. It's because almost instantly he realized that there was no net return of investment for energy trying to get me out. And he just went right back on his, and it was some kind of weird laboratory he had going there where he was monkeying about with other bits of consciousness. And he went about his business as though I didn't matter anymore. So I was more of a minor annoyance in that sense than a spy or a real threat or anything. So it was kind of like I was sort of a mosquito in his world, and he'd sort of tried to swat at it, and then I'd flown off far enough and he wasn't willing to reach over there and pursue it. So quite the odd thing. Now, the younger one was different. He was, and I got the impression from the old guy that he was several thousand years old. Okay. You can sort of, you can pull information out of other consciousness if it allows you. So some of the consciousness you encounter are really hard shell spheres, and all you get is whatever is observed in their behavior within that environment. You can't pull anything through, right? But if some of the consciousness, in this is just the way I'm describing it, is involved in thinking about something else, they're leaking out other bits of information that you can pull out and tease out of that mass. And it's a weird process. It's hard to put into words, but like I say, I got the impression the guy was, you know, several thousand years old and was like maybe a senior research kind of a guy. They have no gender, so that was really weird. It's not like I think of them as male because they're ruthless and emotionally empty in their cruelty. So they're cruel, but I don't think they mean to be cruel per se, right? It just never would occur to them that they were being cruel, or that our emotions mattered in any way, shape, or form. The young guy was willing to trade. By the time I met him, I figured out how hyperspace worked a little bit and knew it was quid pro quo, a trade system. So like the guy with the emotions, I traded him the idea of surface coatings, and he told me all about emotions and how emotions are transmitted by the vagus nerve, how you can go emotions forward or backward in time, backward not so much, but forward in time, and all these different technologies of emotions that I had never, ever, ever considered prior to running into him. And so he was quite happy to just spill all of that for me because of this, you know, incredible, you know, Nobel Prize level on his planet idea of paint.
Right. Now, the mantid beings, you would actually describe them as looking like a praying mantis, right?
Nah, you get the impression of a mantis, okay? But no, their bodies are not swooped the way a mantis is. They don't ride on their back haunches the way a mantis does. They don't really have the head structure completely of a mantis. They do at a very base level, okay? But they don't have the protruding sensing antenna on top. It is true that their arms are straight out in front of them. They have no shoulder per se. They've only got a range of motion that's basically up and down or back and forth. you call them a mantid in lieu of something else, but you could just as easily call them an ant.
Would you say that we have had contact with extraterrestrials throughout our history?
Sure.
And would you say there's been some sort of maybe hand in our engineering?
No, very definitely there. We are not natural beings. And there's something far more about that than most people realize. And that is that 85% of all of the biota on this planet that's not a vegetable and not a fungus is an invertebrate. So 85% of all animals on this planet have no spine. And they've been quite happily developing and so on. 15% of the life on the planet does have spines. And I think it's there that we begin to examine where engineering took place. And then you can subset on how developed of a vagus nerve system we actually have in whatever our test subject is. So if you're looking at reptiles, they have a very, 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 very simple vagus nervous system that in no way alters how they do things. Okay, so a reptile will simply respond to whatever the environment is pushing at them, and their preconceived approach to, you know, their instinct in terms of a response: fight, flight, or freeze. And that's why we call that particular part of our brain the reptilian part of the brain, right? Is because it has encoded in it these three modes of action. But we have something that the reptiles don't. We have something that the cetaceans, all of the dolphins and whales, all of those guys do, that is a vagus nervous system, okay? Birds have a very minimal, very, very, very minimal vagus nervous system. More advanced than a reptile, but hardly. Dogs and cats, well, dogs more than cats have a very advanced vagus nervous system. Same thing is true of you know, the large predators, wolves and this sort of thing, and bears. A lot of the herbivores have a very advanced vagus nervous system, but it's very simplified. It's not what we would call polydimensional, okay? It's very narrowly attached in terms of where it goes to the spine and where it goes through the internal organs and how it connects into the head. With us, the vagus nervous system connects to all of our senses, okay? So your eyes, your ears, your nose, and your mouth. So the vagus nervous system is connected to that. It's connected to your brain, and it's connected to all the glands in your head, all of the pituitary gland, the thymus, the thyroid, the pineal gland, all of these are connected to the vagus nervous system. It goes down around on the outside of your spine. It's not part of your central nervous system. And then it connects every organ in the body with the exception of the adrenal complex. And it is rooted in the pancreas. So the vagus nervous system is the way in which humans have telepathy. So it's very unlike the kind of telepathy that the emotional guy had, or the kind of telepathy that the bugs have, because our kind of telepathy comes through our hormonal antenna, which is the vagus nervous system. Our nervous system, our vagus nervous system, is so complex that if you were to take it out of the human body and spread it out, you'd be able to cover several sheets of plywood with it. It's just vast. And it acts as a conduit for hormones. And it takes serotonin from your gut, moves it up to your brain. It takes adrenaline, moves it over here. It takes all these different hormones and moves those throughout your body. It is hormones that give us action. It's hormones that provide us with desire and feeling from which we get thought. And without those hormones, we don't have a motivating factor. And so it is. We're entirely hormonal beings this way. And it is possible for one human to entrain their state of their vagus nervous system. It's possible for us to entrain our vagus nervous system to those of another human in a very crude fashion. Okay, we don't yet have full control where we can turn our vagus nervous system into a particular state we might want, and then broadcast it out so that someone else can hook up with us and ride the wave. Okay, the guy that I met in hyperspace that had the shimmery emotions, their species can do that. Okay, they can decide how they want to feel and alter with their consciousness the hormonal balance within their system, which then ends up projecting just the image of the emotions and these multicolored bands and hues and shimmeriness across their skin exactly the way they want. Very much like an artist would mix colors to get just the precise color that they would want, the nuances. So this guy was like, that species is like elevated beyond us maybe a million or so years relative to emotions and the vagus nervous system and everything, right? We're really crude, but we have it within us to be able to do this eventually. And we have proof of this on the planet right now, a couple of different ways. 68% of all communication is visual. So beyond the words, you have this initial impression of dealing with someone. You get an initial impression on them that does not exist. That it isn't dependent on anything they say. So this visual impression, these 68% of the information that's communicated by all of that, that grabs you, is doing so at what we would say a visceral level, a gut level, the viscera. And that visceral level is really referring to the vagus nerve. There's some people you just run into and it's like, no, I can't stand that son of a bitch. And for whatever reason, you know, you don't even know the guy and you don't like him. And that's your vagus nervous system responding to his. Now, we take advantage of this, and you can go and look it up. The New Zealanders and the Australians had this thing, and as did the Swedish and the Norwegians. Now, they didn't. The northern states didn't call it the same, but in New Zealand, it's called the haka. And the haka is this complex emotional entrainment process among a group of guys, so that they're all entrained mentally and they're all reacting in the same level of high energy performance with very narrow levels of error, because they've got all of their vagus nervous systems all in agreement. And so the haka is, from our outside viewpoint, a bunch of guys standing around stomping their feet, making weird arm movements and yelling and making strange faces at each other. But if you look at the group as a whole, you find that what's actually going on is, as I'm stating, an entrainment, a sort of vagus nervous system telepathy, a group consciousness that evolves from those people that are practicing this haka. And there's rules to the haka in terms of how the New Zealanders have it, but there's also rules in my sense of it as an entrainment device, how it needs to be, what you need to do in order to have it work. But it's very powerful. And it goes along with the kia, the big voice in karate and judo and all of that kind of stuff, right? and the harmonizing of or the projecting of your state out into the world as a whole. So yeah, so in that sense, we are telepathic beings, but we're just not telepathic the way most people would think, where, you know, I'm beaming over to you my hot dog order.
Right. Now, do you think that this, our telepathic abilities and all these abilities, are intentionally suppressed from us in a way, you know, just made to seem like it's just woo-woo, it's not possible intentionally?
That speaks to, I know that that is the case, that they are being suppressed. Okay, so I can agree that indeed that there is a level of suppression on there. But the idea of an intent, we'd have to say, then that instantly brings up the issue of who and why. And I couldn't answer either of those. Okay, I know that people might culturally suppress this sort of thing. And there's a lot of different reasons why they would do it at various different levels. So if you look at some of the photos of and videos of Biden, the politician, right, you get the distinct impression that this guy is a slathering pedophile. And that he's always trying to touch all of these young kids, especially early pubescent females that are presented in public places near him. Now, you also see that the other males around him in his party and other parties will do things to discipline him in front of the camera in very subtle ways. So they're aware of his activities, and they're not pointing fingers and calling him out. They're not decking the son of a bitch. They're not having him arrested because they have a vested interest in his being in that position. And so they'll slap his hand down. They'll push his hand away from their grandkid. You know, they'll put their knee up against him in the background, that kind of thing, right? And so they have an inbuilt profit motive, so to speak, for keeping him there, and they're aware of the behavior and so on. And but so is this part of some larger evil plot to maintain his presence, or is it just a natural, you know, I can't rock the boat because my power is dependent on their power kind of thing?
Now, I'd like to kind of shift gears a little bit for the second half here. I'd like to get your thoughts on what's going on at CERN. There's a lot of disinformation. There's, you know, talks of they're opening portals, they're talking to beings in different dimensions, all kinds of stuff. What is really going on at CERN? And are there any implications that it could be dangerous for everyone?
There's a lot of indications it's dangerous for everyone. I don't know what's really going on there. And we would have to ask the question such as, what's really going on there? And then what do they think they're doing? Okay, I could actually state right now that what's really going on there, insofar as we're able to determine, is that they're failing. Okay, whatever their goal is, they're failing at it. And now we're talking about the Large Hadron Collider, the big spinning thing under the ground, because if you say CERN, CERN are the people that invented HTML and released it out on the nascent internet in 1993 or 92. And so CERN is a huge organization, much of it devoted to atomic stuff, right? But CERN in Europe with the Large Hadron Collider, their announced official idea of what they're attempting to achieve makes no sense. It makes sense only in a very narrowly defined region of physics that doesn't seem to have a whole lot of support in larger academia. So it's curious that this is the largest machine ever built by humans, and it's pursuing this very narrow little band. Now, these guys could indeed figure that they're going to open up a portal to another dimension. They could figure they're going to create a black hole. They could have any number of ideas, most of which could never happen because their paradigm is goofy. So if for instance, these same scientists are of the opinion that the sun is a nuclear reactor of condensed hydrogen, and they were basing all of their paradigm of reality around that, then whatever it is they're doing at CERN will never, ever, ever succeed because their basic paradigm is flawed at a very deep level. Now, we know that they're trying to crash and create subatomic particles. All right. I hate using that term, but all right. So, but let's, they're taking these little tiny bits of shaved off parts of atoms, and they're smashing them into each other, and they're creating clouds. These clouds are then analyzed by the computers. That's what the Large Hadron Collider does, is it basically smacks these two particles in this little chamber that is a camera. And when the two particles smack, the camera's recording this, and it and these two particles create these fractional lines everywhere, these spectrally kind of lines, vast clouds, little tiny lines going every which way. And they're doing this thing constantly, smashing as many particles as they can continuously. And they're analyzing the resulting cloud photos for various specific parameters that they hope to see. And what they're actually attempting to do is to like further refine our understanding, or what this would actually do is it would further refine our understanding of what an atom is. Which gets us off into a real discussion here of base electric universe theory. Because within the electric universe, there is not a nuclear force. So when we actually take uranium and we smash that atom and we split that atom apart, it is not an electric, it's not a nuclear force that's released, it's electrical. Because we're ripping the electrons loose from their shell and ripping the protons apart. And so we're separating that atom and releasing its electrical nature that binds all of those bits and pieces together. So if the people at CERN were aware of the electric universe, then what they're doing with the Large Hadron Collider could be interpreted in an entirely different way than if they thought that we lived in a world where the sun is this nuclear reactor as opposed to an electric arc, electric plasma arc. Because in such an electric universe, then we know that the spectral lines, the mass spectral lines, don't add up, never ever add up to the way that the periodic table of elements would have you believe. So the periodic table of elements, for instance, has gold having an atomic weight of 79, meaning that there's this mass in there that's got 79 of these little critters in it, right? But if you were to smash gold inside the Large Hadron Collider and smash that molecule open, you don't get 79 little particles flying off in various different directions. You might get 10,000. So our understanding of atoms and what they are and how they work and this sort of thing is very much mistaken at the level taught in mainstream academia based on the periodic table of elements. So we might discover that aluminum, for instance, aluminum might have just one base state, which is, you know, this is stainless steel, but, you know, just basically there might just be one base state. But if you were to treat aluminum differently, you might be able to get radioactive aluminum, transparent aluminum, like we saw on Star Trek, aluminum that was soft and yet you couldn't put your finger through it, aluminum that could be stretched. All of these things could be determined if you had a spectral line analysis profile of aluminum that included every possibility of how that cloud would develop when the aluminum particle was smashed up. That makes sense?
Right, yes.
Okay, so in that sense, CERN could be used for that. But we have to ask ourselves, where is the return on investment for taking such a huge proportion of the world's scientific dollars and putting them into the largest machine ever built with the largest number of people outside of the Manhattan Project? Devoted to a single purpose behind a quote scientific machine. Are they intending to set themselves up as our materials developers as we go into the future? If so, well, then okay, we would get a return on investment. All of our tax dollars being siphoned off to support CERN would pay for something because we'd get newer types of aluminum, newer kinds of steel, newer kinds of plastic, if that's what they're doing. On the other hand, like I say, they may actually think that there's multiple dimensions and that they're going to open up a portal into it and off we go.
Now, there are some thoughts that they could be in some way affecting some of the Earth changes we're seeing now. Do you think that's possible? Because I know we are seeing a lot of Earth changes. I cover that. And, you know, I'd also like to get your thoughts on what we're actually going through right now with the uptick of all the volcanoes and earthquakes and strange weather.
Yeah, it's all interrelated. The CERN guys, before we get into the weather, we have to acknowledge that the CERN guys are generating more electricity than any other project on the planet. And they're doing it underground, where their apparatus is buried into quartzite under a big chunk of Europe. Quartzite being a highly conductive material. And so they're putting more electricity into the planet than anybody's ever done before. However, I really don't think that they're actually participating in any of the stuff that's going on at a planet-wide level. They may be able to, with the amount of electricity they're putting in, tip certain conditions in a certain day. But even acknowledging that these guys are vast electricity hogs and are shoving it into the ground, they're probably not putting as much energy into the planet as we get from let's just pick Madagascar, the island of Madagascar, from solar energy, okay, just because we get so much energy from the sun. So I'm personally of the opinion that all the stuff that's happening on the Earth relative to weather is 100% related to the sun. And I doubt the humans, even if we took all of our cars, all of our electrical generation, everything we've ever done, and CERN, I don't think we even come up to a fraction of 1%. So, especially with the sun. Now, the sun is dimming. We're going into a grand solar minimum. It'll be apparent in 2020. You won't be able to deny it after the winter of 2020. Probably, if you're smart, you're not denying it already that we're going into a grand solar minimum, right, a mini ice age. But by 2020, it'll be, even the mainstream media will have frozen enough to be able to not deny this, right? And we'll see 2 years by 2020 where we've had just extremely cold summers. And as a result of the dimming of the sun, its reduction of its corona, it's a plasma over around a solid body. It's an electrical plasma. And it's dimming from 5,000 Kelvin down to 3,000 Kelvin. And that means that it's shrinking its corona around the hard mass of the sun. That means cosmic rays are coming around it much further, much denser, and striking more of the planets. When the cosmic rays strike Earth, we get volcanoes, we get earthquakes, because of the huge amount of energy that they're imparting way into the middle of our planet in our plasma core that is acting as an absorbing sponge for these cosmic rays. Now, we're sort of the reverse of the sun. So the sun has a giant plasma that has provided all the light and the heat and so forth for the solar system. And it's around a solid metal core. On Earth, we have a solid crust and a mantle and the everything on top of that around a plasma core. And so in that sense, we're the reverse. And we have these electrical interchanges with the sun very predictably. So it's very clear as to why hurricanes come at a certain time of the year and never any other time of the year. That's because at that particular time, which usually begins in August, we have this thing called the return current sheet of all of this returning electricity that goes from the Earth back to the sun. Whenever the return current sheet starts up, electricity rises up out of that part of the Atlantic. The storms form because the electricity can't ground out and it's heading on its way out to the sun. And it brings down opposite polarity electricity that wants to ground out, comes down in a circular fashion, and we get hurricanes. But so hurricanes are entirely electrical. The only reason that the water is warm is that they happen to happen in August. And so, but they're not happening because the water is warm. It's a correlation, not a causation. And so the warm water is meaningless relative to the size of the storms or any of that. Many of the ideas that we have as humans are really kind of silly and are off. But if we understood a lot more of this, well, then we might even be able to deduce what the hell they think they're doing at CERN.
So what do you see happening in the next couple of years? You said that we're going to go into an ice age. Can you give us a little bit about how that might occur?
Well, it's already occurring.
Right.
Okay, so as the sun shrinks, not only do we get more cosmic rays that come around, which strip parts of our atmosphere off, making us more vulnerable to more cosmic rays, but there's also this activity called extreme ultraviolet. So as the sun's corona shrinks, a part of the spectra within that corona intensifies, and we get this stuff called EUV. It started getting really serious in about 96 or 97. We had this new type of UV, ultraviolet rays. We had this new type of light at a new frequency level touching the actual surface of the ground in 2002. As far as we knew, it had never come down that far before. It was always bouncing off of the atmosphere. But in 2002, it was so intense, it burst down and actually touched the planet. Now it's happening all the time. So we have UV A, B, and C, which are is this band in the ultraviolet spectra. Now, as we go further forward, we'll probably get a UV D. Bear in mind that as we get into the increasing letters, we're getting much more intense frequencies, very much more amplitude and very high frequency ultraviolet rays, which bring in vast quantities of energy, causes a lot of evaporation out of the water. So starting in 2002, I was projecting we were going to have lakes in the sky, rivers in the sky that would create these incredible deluges in a very short period of time. The reason that they were occurring turns out to be the UVC. Now we're going to get a lot more of them. A lot more water is going to go up into the sky. It's going to come over to areas and fall down. A lot of it will come down as snow, and it'll stay as snow because of the generalized dampening of the sun and the diminution of our temperatures. Even at a small level, we'll keep a lot more snow around. Therefore, that snow will tend to build up. We'll get new glaciation. And Bob's your uncle. We're in an ice age. Now, at this point, the Russian astrophysicist Katerina Zarkova, I think her name's Katerina, but Zarkova for sure, she has got a projection that has been a four-component deduction of observed behavior of the sun. They've been able to deduce four particular components in a complex equation that produces a three-dimensional graph of the temperature as it relates to Earth based on the sun's activity. So she's able to project that we're going to get the first year of risky vegetation light. Okay, so in 2028, will be the first year of 4 or 5 years in which we may not get enough light on the planet to grow even a fraction of the vegetation that we're growing now. So that'll be the start of the famine period, if that is going to be a determining factor in the famine. But we're going to have extremely cold winters and much cooler summers. So it'll be much cooler summers for the southern hemisphere and more or less their normal winter. And then for the northern hemisphere, while the southern hemisphere is having a much cooler summer, we're going to have brutal, terrible winters. And then as we go into our summer, we'll find that our summer is just like blah. It's very short. It may be briefly intense, but in that intensity of summer, we won't reach anywhere near the record levels that we've seen in the past. So they've been lying to us off of the National Climate Assessment here in the United States. You can tell they're lying to us because their results only go back to 1960. Okay, 1957 and 1958 was the peak in the local or in the recent warming trend. But prior to that, the 30s and the 40s and the 50s were a lot warmer than it was in the 60s and the 70s and now. So we're actually going down in this gradual cooling, going into this mini ice age, and they're trying to convince us that global warming exists by cherry picking data. Why they're trying to convince us of the exact opposite of what our eyes are seeing and we're experiencing, I don't know. Why the governments and all of these people that are in the mega corporations and so on are trying to have vast numbers of humans freeze to death and not prepare, I don't know. Why are we wasting our money on CERN when we should be trying to figure out how to grow food through a minimum and a grand solar minimum? I have no idea. But it'll be as bad as the Maunder minimum and the, I think they called it the Dalton minimum. Okay, now bear in mind, it was during these periods of time in the 1600s and the 1100s, when we had these previous solar minimums, that much of the chaos of our planet existed. You know, Rome falls in their time, Rome fell in a solar minimum, and because resources get constrained. Genghis Khan and the Mongolians moved out of their area because the snowpack and everything was destroying their ability to graze. So vast quantities of changes happen here throughout these periods. The whole German and Central European society shifted off of grains and started living off of root vegetables and cruciferous vegetables like cabbage and so on as a result of the solar minimum, because you couldn't grow grains because your summer was too short. So all different kinds of social and species affecting changes take place in these minimums. And we're starting one in 2020. Absolutely no doubt, if you look at Zarkova's numbers and the model, you know, you could probably pick out which month we're going to have the exceptional weather in 2020.
Now, how long will this period last? And, you know, kind of, I guess, what could people do to prepare, and how bad will this get for people?
Well, it'll be very bad for some people and not so bad for other people. I mean, we can just make assumptions, right? Those people that are in denial and won't do anything will probably run up against a wall of having to try and maintain themselves based on government handouts. Which won't be good, because the government's going to lose more and more ability to control resources at all different kinds of level in all different governments. It just won't make any difference. It's going to last from, well, it'll go from 2020 into probably 2061 before there's enough of a let up that we'll see a re-flourishing of a social order. But it'll still be rather cold from 2061 to up until 2200. So about approximately 180 years total, it'll be affecting the weather. But from 2061, it'll be a gradual warming up. We'll have seen most of the really nasty, situations descend on us by 2061. And our climate should at that point be relatively stable, gradually warming again, for the next, 120 years after that. Now, in terms of how we're going to prepare, food, energy, other resources like medicines, clothing, et cetera, are going to be, we're going to have to look at it very rationally, I think. And as a human, I'm going to have to say, can I count on getting, goose down coats from southern China? Well, maybe not, you know, for whatever reasons, political, geopolitical, economic, or resource constraints in the sense of, you know, the snow clamping down and populations being shifted and so on. It won't be that there'll be a lot of formation of glaciers and you'll have to run away from the glacier and, you know, that kind of thing. It won't be that sort of a mini ice age. There will be new glaciers and they will affect populations, but not the way that the large ice ages in about 12,000 years ago affected things. So for us, it's going to be much more like not able to graze beef or sheep or that sort of thing in North America in, say, from 2030 onward. And it might be, you know, a decade or more before we're actually able to raise enough grain or grass to be able to go back to being running herds. I mean, that's a real probability, not a possibility. I mean, there's actually some level of projection you can make as to statistically how likely that is to occur, because we saw it happen repeatedly in the last solar minimums. And we know from records here in North America that at the same time that the Dalton minimum was forcing the populations of Central Europe to change over from grains, we had a very large die-off of herds here in the U.S. that were grass dependent.
Yeah, and it is very concerning that people aren't being told about what's going to happen and, you know, not really being given a chance to prepare for this. With that, if it's going to cause even more problems, as of, you know, just the lack of people knowing, probably add to the amount of loss of life and...
Sure, the butthead factor, right. Yeah. If you live in a town full of buttheads, and there's something that triggers all the buttheads into rioting, then you could get hurt simply because they're buttheads and they don't know what's going on. So they might be, you know, set off by anything, and it's their ignorance, their paradigm that's setting them off, and yet they're still a danger to you, and there's very little you can do about that when you're dealing with mobs. And so it makes sense to do to react rationally, in my opinion. Either dedicate yourself to educating vast numbers of people around you such that you raise the general level of knowledge and lower the ignorance level, you know, in your area, or isolate yourself, or try and find another place that's more that's going in the direction of, you know, acknowledgement of reality, et cetera, and make sensible choices. You've got a few years. All right. So between now and 2028, we'll still have the ability to travel. At some point, that'll break down because of winter conditions lasting much longer than anybody anticipated, and resource constraints and all different kinds of things. So as an instance, you know, get a giant storm, the storm sticks around for 3 weeks, airport shut down, and even beyond the airport itself shutting down from the weather, maybe it can't open for another couple of months because refineries are damaged and you can't get jet fuel. So under the circumstances, that you might have whole regions of various continents that don't have travel available. This will become an increasing scenario, increasing in everybody's life as we go forward. It'll impact things like vacations and cruise plannings and these kind of things at a very mundane or trivial level, but it'll affect things like medicines, logistics for transporting goods for sale, all of those sorts of things at a very macro level, and we'll all feel it in increased prices, reduced choices, and so on.
Yes, definitely. And Cliff, I have one more question for you before we close out tonight. I was wondering about your thoughts on 5G and any possible dangers to us, and what it could possibly be about.
5G is an interesting subject, okay? It is a ultra-high microwave frequency. It's a very wide band as a carrier wave. So it's very attractive to technology because you can put a lot of information on it, a lot more information on it than, say, a radio frequency in an FM band, right? A lot, you could get a lot more information in a 5G Wi-Fi network. So we could have 4K color both ways, instant transmission, and a dozen spare channels with a 5G in lieu of Wi-Fi. The problem with 5G is that its intensity is such, its frequency is so high, which is what makes it an attractive bandwidth carrier, but its frequency is so high that it actually penetrates in to the human body. It penetrates in a way that is very shallow, but can nonetheless be very damaging. It is actually used, and 5G is used in a laboratory setting to examine human DNA in thin tissue samples. Okay, they put 5G into all of the airports around the United States in the forms of those full-body scanners. And we've had lots of people that develop cancers as a result of running those devices, and they're not an attractive thing, and it's not a burgeoning trending technology. In my opinion, they may have put those things in there to determine who was human and who was not, because the 5G, being a DNA level reflective ray, not only shows you your body, but could bring back DNA information within that information being sent back to the scanner. You're just not showing it on the picture is all, but they may be actually reading parts of your DNA with that 5G. It is dangerous as a wave to be around because of that penetration. It's not a mind control thing because it can't go through your skull. It could probably go through the epidermal layers on my bald head, but on your head with that hair there, a lot of it would be dissipated by the hair itself. And so you wouldn't have the same level of penetration there that I would. But neither one of us could that ray actually penetrate in and affect our neural pathways and stuff. But it may very well cause all kinds of skin cancers, may very well cause all kinds of eruptive blood issues, you know, hematomas and leukemias, this sort of thing, because it's very nasty. And in fact, it's used as a, in its examination of DNA, you can use 5G to like cut DNA sections. So it's that disruptive to it. It just doesn't have vast quantities of power. And that it's not like they're going to put up one big giant 5G antenna that's just going to flood the whole area with 5G waves. That's the way it is with cell phones. You see, the cell phone towers are considerable distance apart. Line of sight, they might be 20 or 30 miles, hilltop to hilltop kind of thing, and they still get a decent reception. 5G can't work that way because it doesn't. It has a lot of power in it, but it fades so rapidly. And so the way that 5G is going to have to work is bazillions of 5G repeaters everywhere. So we'll be like living in a stew of 5G that's being broadcast around you from every different perspective in a city, in the sense of, you know, off of the walls of buildings, out of the 5G repeaters that'll be put into every lamppost, that'll be put on every parking meter, that'll be stuck in everybody's house, all of this kind of things. So the intensity of the 5G will be massively overwhelming. Now, good news for me, I live out here on the coast. Right now there's a probably 93% humidity as it's raining and foggy. 5G won't operate. It simply is disrupted by water vapor. So anywhere you've got fog, you're going to have really piss poor reception with 5G, which is protective of the people that are involved with it. But I suspect, this friend of mine who's a scientist, a former NASA scientist, and really a spooky fellow, although very nice, he's of the opinion that 5G will last as long as the first class action suit for skin cancer as a result of exposure. And I have a tendency to agree with him. It should be an extremely rapid degradation of the humans that are involved in being around the stuff all the time. And if we look at the biochemists specifically that are involved or that go into DNA analysis using 5G, the insurance companies give them a 3-year less lifespan than a regular biochemist. So an insurance company thinks a biochemist has an average lifespan of 55 years. But if they mess with the 5G, doing DNA analysis and biochemistry work at that level, they've got a 52-year lifespan. So even the insurance companies acknowledge this in their actuarial tables.
Well, wow. Now you said a lot there, but one thing that caught my ear that we're going to have to pick up on next time, I'm going to have you back on. That was some amazing information, but you said that they may be monitoring people's DNA to find out who's human.
And correct.
That's just right there. That blows my mind. And I know we don't have time to get into it tonight. Right, that will definitely make a very interesting conversation for next time. And Cliff, sure. Thank you so much for joining us. That was, like I said, fantastic information. We're going to have you back on.
Sure. Glad to. Yep.
Well, you have a great night, Cliff.
Yep. Same to you. Keep your hair. It's you know, protective.
I'll try. I will.
Okay.
All right.